You are tuned to the Nothing Is Real Radio Hour, broadcast every fifth Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM as part of Free 103.9's Transmission Arts programming. I'm Sam Sebrin, and for this special edition called Everything Is Eel, environmental educator Liz Lojudis and myself co-produced a program about Anguilla rostrata, or the American eel. You will hear the voices of Chris Bowser, John Lipscomb, Ken Tsukada, Barbara Heinzman, Dee Stranitza, Mark Grennan, John Cannon, Alta Turner, Ron Locke, Zareda Maloney, myself, Liz, and kids from Jeannie Cardinet's second grade class at the Coxsackie Elementary School. Also, music was specially created for this broadcast by the Eel People. Let's listen.
Hi, Sam. This is Liz Lojudis. I'm calling to thank you for your interest in becoming a volunteer for the American Eel Project. And we're really pleased that you're interested in helping us check the net for glass eels, the baby American eels that come up into the Hanakoi Creek. So give me a call so we can start getting you into our schedule. My number is 518-622.
The first time Liz told me about the Eel Project, I was completely fascinated, and I knew I wanted to be a part of it and learn more.
The Eel Project is a study of the migration of the American eel into the Hudson River and some of the tributary streams that run into the river. This project is headed up by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation's Hudson River Estuary Program, and it involves groups of volunteers working together to set nets in tributary streams and check those nets every day for young eels that are moving into the tributaries from the river. And this project takes place for around 6 weeks each spring, and there are several tributary streams where nets are set. And in Greene County, there's a net in the Hanakoi Creek, which is located on the north end of the county in the town of New Baltimore.
Wading into the Hanakoi Creek, I plunged into the project. I soon met a cast of characters who conspired to educate me about this mysterious fish.
Eels are very cool.
We're talking about eels.
These guys are so much of a mystery.
The eel is a kind of a cool little critter.
The eel gets no respect.
Yeah, eels have been around for a long time since dinosaurs.
The dorsal fin, you can tell that it's an eel.
Which means it's a fish, right?
Yeah, it's a fish.
A fish, how do you know it's a fish?
Yeah, he's got fins and he's also got gills. So this is a fish, it's not a snake, it's not a reptile, it is actually a fish.
They are both saltwater and freshwater fish.
There's a lot of unknowns about eels, which make them probably one of the most fascinating creatures in the ocean.
The whole story is just amazing when I tell people.
You mean about eels?
Yeah, of coming from the Sargasso Sea and all the way up here. People have no idea.
Do you guys remember where eels are born?
Just say it.
Sargasso Sea.
Yes, exactly. They're born in Sargasso Sea, which is in between Bermuda and Puerto Rico. So, does anybody know roughly how many miles they swim to get to the Hudson River? Yes.
1,000?
Yes, a little over 1,000 miles.
So, glass eels are the very young, probably about a year old eels, and they're completely transparent, which is why they're called glass eels, right?
Correct. They are come directly from the ocean. And basically, when they're still in salt water, all you can really see is two little black eyes and a little bit of their vertebrae. But basically, they're almost totally transparent. You can see their heart, lungs. And usually the eels are trying to go upstream with the least amount of resistance. So the way they do that is to avoid the current coming down on a good sized stream. And they use the incoming tide to push them up. So those are the ways that basically an eel can preserve its energy for climb up.
One of the theories is that during new and full moons, when the high tides are highest, that's when eels use that high tide to help them ride into these tributaries.
So they travel 1,000 miles to get up here to the Hudson, and then they'll stay here. The males will stay for 7-10 years, the females a little bit longer, up to 30 years max. And then where do they go? Yes.
Back to the Sargasso Sea,
exactly. And then they'll spawn once, and then they'll die. So that's their life cycle.
Because they can't breed them in captivity.
No.
They're not even quite sure how they breed
They don't know anything about them. The youngest one they've ever found was in the Sargasso Sea, and they found a Alvin that's submersible. But they still don't know if that's really where they go.
Oh, that's true. So you mean it's not really proven that that's where they mate? Huh.
But they never find any adults. They never...
Isn't that... What, they just find the glass eels in the Sargasso Sea?
First smallest one they found there.
That's interesting. So they don't find the adults?
No, they've never found an adult.
Basically, an eel was born to be eaten by something. So when they're babies, little fish eat them. When they're grown up, striped bass eat them. I've seen heron eating a 3-foot eel, just swallowing it down their throat. So their whole life is to avoid being prey. And so at nighttime, they hide in the mud and in the grass and everything else. And as the tides come on in, they come into the tide and they try to go up the little streams to live to their adult life, and usually lakes, and when they're ready to come back, they go back to spawn. So every eel you see in New York State has come from the ocean. As I said, eels are incredible little creatures, and what they do is they'll actually have this need to just keep on going upstream, hopefully to find a nice lake to live in for 10, 20 years before they come back down. And they end up going against dams, rock formations, rapids, and anytime there is a situation where they just can't swim, they literally find a grassy area on a slimy rock, and their bodies start roping literally over each other's bodies. So if you go at night, you can see them actually climbing up in these little strands up and over barriers to higher water. It's an incredible sight. I've only seen it twice in my life. And the water has to get warm enough, and then once the water is warm enough, they group up below the barrier and they start climbing up and over. And actually, your NCON people now use that technique to help them up and over dams and other barriers by creating artificial ladders, basically. And these eels use them to go upstream.
Wow.
Eels can stay out of water for 2 days.
Really?
Yeah, it's two.
And then are they going walking across land?
They stay close to water.
I also think the part that's remarkable that most people don't know is that they're going across land and they're amphibious that way.
Right.
You know, and like I was having a coffee with Liz and she ran into one of her neighbors. And he started talking about eels that come across the land and get in his pond.
They can come out of the water.
But they come out of
the
water.
Oh, yeah. They can actually
breathe through their skin.
They come out of the water, and like on a rainy night, they'll go through the grass.
Yeah.
They can go around the dams and everything.
Jen, they're going to take over the world. You know? Can swim in the water, can walk on land. You know?
As eels migrate, they're growing to adulthood. They transform from glass eels to elvers and then into yellow eels. Yellow eels are adults, and they're usually over a foot in length, and they have olive green backs and yellow bellies. And all this time that eels are migrating upstream, they're heading up in elevation as well into the mountains. I've seen female eels in Lake Myosotis in Rensselaerville, which is at an elevation of about 2,000 feet. So they've traveled a long way from sea level to the mountains.
The story of the female eel is frankly more compelling than the male eel. So the female eels will live much longer. They'll live 10, 20, 30 years. And they'll get much bigger. If you have an eel that's over 2 feet, there's very good chances that it's a female eel. Male eels, they tend not to ascend so far into freshwater. They tend to live less, 5 to 10 years. They tend to be smaller, 2 feet long. It's the females that live a long time that get really big, because a big female might have up to 20 million eggs in her when she goes back down to the Sargasso. So, you know, she's the reason that she's up here in this freshwater is that it's a place to eat, to build body fat. When that body fat gets to a certain, you know, when her health gets to a certain size, that digestive tract withers away. She's done eating. She just becomes a one-way missile of reproduction back down to the Sargasso.
The female is bigger than the male, so don't think that the male is a kid. The female is very big.
I think the girls enjoy that the female's bigger.
It's finally a chance to be bigger than the boys.
Have you seen the silver eels in Hudson? They're big.
So silver eels, the eels that we're counting are
glass eels. Those are the babies. And the silver eels are the ones that are going back to the Sargasso Sea.
Yeah, they're ready to leave.
They're on their way. And what's that business about stomachs being dissolved? I didn't quite get that.
That what?
When they're ready to reproduce, their stomachs dissolve.
Yeah, because they don't eat after they turn into silver eels.
Why not? What's all that about?
I don't know. It has something to do with them going out and breeding. I don't know. But they're
saving their energy for the good stuff.
Yeah, right. They're big eels.
Yeah, you know.
So you wonder what they look like after they've gone that far. They had
well,
them
you know what?
Weight.
Like, yeah, I, you know, whether they even survive it after that.
Why are they called silver?
They don't think they do.
Do
but.
Yeah, and maybe that's why none of the adults are found.
Oh yeah, that's possible.
You know, that could be a piece of the puzzle right there.
Look at the shad and all those things that come up the river and die.
Right.
That go to Europe, are they slightly different?
So that's a different species. Very closely related, same genus, but a slightly different species. They take a lot longer. It takes them basically an extra year to get there. But they're also, they have a similar lifestyle. They're born basically in the same place, the Sargasso Sea. It just takes them longer to get there. One of the big questions, so both the European and the American eels will live up in the watersheds for 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 years, and then they'll migrate back. The big question is, when those eels, let's take New York, here's the Hudson River right here, okay, we're right about at the T. When those eels leave, the question is, do they cross the Gulf Stream to head to the Sargasso Sea, or do they ride that current all the way around, past Europe, past Africa, and come into the Sargasso Sea from this direction?
Wow, so they're both originating at the same place.
Yeah,
bank.
And somewhere out in the sea, someone's taking a left and someone's taking a right, heading to Europe. Right. Pretty interesting.
Well, not only that, but when they get to this country, they're in the Chesapeake, the Hudson,
right.
Up in Maine, they're all over. So
I'm told they'll even get into the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
And they'll go through the canals and the Mohawk River.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because it's a little longer swim, I guess, to Europe. From, you know, because the Sargasso Sea, that's like over where Bermuda area out in there, right? So, you know, obviously it's closer east coast. And then you wonder if that's what attributes to the more vertebrae. As they're developing, they're swimming more, you know. I mean, it seems to make sense biologically, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking, that there's a genetic advantage for the longer trip and having six vertebrae.
They say, man, if we got to keep swimming like this, we better grow a few more vertebrae. Tail's got to get a little longer here.
This is going to take us a while.
Yeah.
Um, people eat the eels?
Yeah, they eat eels.
Different cultures use eels differently. The Spaniard has a garlic and olive oil, of course, dish with glass eels. And literally, it's like a bowl of spaghetti, an expensive bowl of spaghetti, but it just comes in a plate, and it's just the raw eel, like a ceviche or something, they just a little olive oil and garlic, and they eat them that way. And the Dutch smoke them, and they eat them like hot dogs. You have little sabot-type stands along the street with smoked eels hanging down. They wrap it up with a piece of wax paper, and off you go. There is a tradition that you should eat a live eel with sake or liquor for nighttime virility. And so what you do is you get these eels, and I think the drinks were like $100 a pop or something like that. And you put the eel in your drink, and then you just swallow it down with your liquor. And rumor has it that was supposed to increase your evening enjoyment.
In the U.S., it used to be commonplace for people to catch and eat eels.
They used to catch them out of Catskill Creek all the time. And what they would do, they'd get a piece of nylon hose and put either meat in it or a bunch of worms in it. And you just tie it off and you put it on a rope and you just put it in the creek. And when you feel someone tugging, you just bring it up slowly, put it in. Because eels have no real teeth. And their teeth would get stuck on the nylon. So you could actually just put a boatload of eels without a hook. They would just get their teeth caught on the nylon, and you just kind of raise them up, drop them in the boat, they would let go, and just do it again. It's called bobbing, eel bobbing.
Eels as a source of sustenance have fallen out of favor in much of the Northeast. In the Hudson River, eels are exposed to PCBs and other contaminants, so the New York State Department of Health advises against eating the fish. And, you know, since eels have no value as a food fish or as a sports fish, they are misunderstood and disrespected by many anglers.
I didn't think much about eels until I started working with Riverkeeper. And the thing that comes to mind for me is how marvelous a creature they are and how they get zero respect. And so when I think of eels, I actually find it sort of a mixture of awesome and really tragic. And a vivid image that I have is on Piermont Pier. When I had a dog, I would walk out there in the mornings when I had time. And there's a lot of fishing there. And, you know, guys would catch eels. They were really fishing for a striped bass. But they would catch an eel. And I have this image of a guy catching an eel. And eels, as I'm told, have slime on them because they live in the bottom sediment where there's lots of bacteria. So the slime is protective. And if you just think about it that way, it's a marvelous adaptation. But so these fishermen, this fisherman that I remember seeing, he didn't want to touch the eel. And so he put his foot on it, and he yanked the hook out of its face. And then he went back to fishing. Didn't take the trouble even to throw it back into the river. And that sticks in my mind. It was a terrible, terrible way to treat a living creature. And, you know, we all get, you know, mushy over monarch butterflies. But this eel story is no less fantastic than the monarch butterfly. But the eel gets no respect.
So what happened when you pulled up an eel instead of a fish?
Hey, it's an interesting experience. Yeah, it is a very unique animal.
But they're, you know, squirming around. They're trying to get off the hook, and you're trying to get them off. You can't do either one.
Well, that's the thing about, like, with fishermen. I want to talk to more fishermen and get their stories because, I mean, I've just seen guys down on the dock at Athens, and when they get an eel, it's like they're pissed off and they try to slam it and, like, kill it or whatever. They can't get it off their line, and they're really frustrated by the eel.
Yeah, they do that in the Mohawk, too. The same thing.
Yeah.
They're too
much like snakes, aren't they?
Hey, I got a story about when Ethan caught a huge eel.
You caught a huge eel?
No, my brother did.
He did?
Yeah.
Was he fishing?
He was fishing on the Hudson River with my older brother Alex and Chris and my dad. And he felt something grabbing at it, and then he was tugging, and he just saw this big snake thing that he didn't thought was an eel. But then when he got it into the boat, it was a huge eel.
Although people in our region may not be happy when they catch an eel, they actually are in demand in many other parts of the world. Eels can't be bred in captivity, so people actually catch glass eels and then grow them in fisheries for use as food.
What about eel sushi? That's pretty prevalent, and every sushi joint has eel sushi. Yeah.
Well, that won't be the glass eels.
So this is the selling of, by the pound, of the glass eels.
Yeah, that's why it's so expensive, because it takes so many glass eels to create a pound.
The only reason you catch eels is you can't grow them in captivity, so you have to catch the baby eels out of the ocean, and the only way to do that is to go out at night and pick them up and shoot them up to the airport, put them in bags of oxygen, and off they go, and you pray that they stay alive through the trip. Catching them, shipping them to Asia, putting them in fish farms both in Japan and in China. One of the years we were working, the headlines in the news were people abandoning their slot machines to go fishing because there was more money to be made catching eels than gambling. So literally people would, in dresses and everything else, just go out and get their dip net and start fishing for eels. And there was literally thousands of dollars to be made. In the night. The only state you're allowed to catch eels in America now is in Maine. They still have significant runs, and generally speaking, they export over 1,000 to 2,000 kilos every season, and that's in a month. So if you multiply that times 2,000, that's quite a few eels that are pulling out of the ocean, and they've been doing that for at least 30 years. So given that, you kind of have to question whether or not the fishery itself is what has made the population crash. I can tell you that the number of eels in Lake Champlain now are way low. It used to be a major fishery, large eels out of Lake Champlain, and of course the Delaware River was another one with their weirs, but the speculation there is that since the old days, we've created better dams that are concrete and drier, and these are actually effective blocks against the eels getting to their growing grounds, like Lake Champlain. So it's certainly, it's a major issue, I think, the quality of the dams that we have now versus the old wooden ones 100 years ago. So it should be interesting to hear what the reports are. There are diseases that affect them. There's a parasite. There's a lot of unknowns about eels, which make them probably one of the most fascinating creatures in the ocean.
Eel populations are in decline worldwide, including American eels. Because of a concern for eel populations and an interest in increasing understanding of this fish, the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission has established a monitoring program looking at populations of glass eels moving into the rivers on the eastern seaboard each spring. The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation's Hudson River Estuary Program has expanded the monitoring program to study glass eels entering into several tributaries of the Hudson River. So the Hudson River Eel Project involves teams of volunteers in different streams, setting and checking a net and counting the eels caught in that net daily. And it happens for about 6 weeks each spring that glass eels are monitored entering tributary streams from the Hudson River.
I hope we catch 1,000 eels.
On a daily basis, volunteer citizen scientists check the fike nets for glass eels. First, we measure water and air temperatures. Then we put on waders and go into the creek to collect the eels from the net. We bring them ashore in a bucket where we count them and record the data in a logbook.
Well, they're basically called fight nets, and they have usually two wings up to, depending on where you are, 20 feet would be a good size wing. And there's hoops, and each hoop has a funnel, and you're funneling these eels through these hoops, and they eventually get caught in the back catch bag. Fight nets are all sizes. Some are stationary like ours. You control with fight type of nets too. It's a classic net that anyone in the industry would know.
Maybe my favorite part of the eel counting experience is wading upstream with a bucket of counted eels and setting them free on their merry way to head upstream where they won't be recaptured by our net. In our stream, the Hanacori Creek in Greene County, which is the northernmost monitoring site in the Hudson Valley, we walk 100 yards or so upstream. At other monitoring sites, however, volunteers bring the counted eels above dams if necessary.
And you know, Hanacori Creek is a great site because the water quality there is so superb. You know, when you go there and there's caddisflies and stoneflies, in the tidal zone, you know you've got a special place.
How long have you been doing it?
I think this is our third year.
Mm-hmm.
The projects up and down the Hudson started earlier, I think, and we and Liz lobbied hard to get the Hanacori included. And I think it was 3 years ago, first time. But it's great to get kids and people in the river. It's a beautiful river. I mean, it's clean water, and this year's been kind of cold, but...
Yeah, the first time I went in, it was... I was glad I had the waders on.
They're a must.
And
your hands get cold, so you have trouble with the knots. Now it's warm. Now it's way warmer.
So here's the deal. Hanacori Creek, basically just south of Albany, more or less. And in the past, we've gotten eels there, but never high numbers. This year, within the first week of sampling, we were catching hundreds of eels, hundreds at a time. And when you look at the graph of eel data, that first, I can't remember if it was a new or full moon, but that first high tide, you had several days of astronomically high numbers, and then it sunk back down to your normal level. It almost looked like there had been a giant stampede of eels up the river. On that, but it just paired perfectly with that first lunar high tide that we had of the season.
Do you guys want to know how many eels we caught all together in the Hudson River this year?
Yes.
So, all right, let's start by saying 2 years ago we caught 11,000. Last year we caught a little over 7,000. Does anybody have any guesses of how many eels we caught this year? Yeah. A million? That would have took a long time to count. Nope, not a million. Yep.
Like somewhere around 80,000?
Yeah, we caught over 84,000 glass eels this year. So,
wow.
It was a huge year. And not only did we catch a lot of eels, they came in a lot earlier. So we started catching eels in late February, whereas normally we wouldn't start getting eels into the Hudson until March. So it was an early year for eels, and it was also a good, strong year for eels.
Why this happened? Man, that is a question. You kind of want to point at the early spring. Say, hey, it was a warm spring, right? That must be why. Except remember, these eels were born a year ago. They're a year old. They don't know what the spring's going to be like. Their parents left the East Coast another 6 months before that, a year and a half ago. So there's no good answer why.
You're listening to Everything is Eel on the Nothing is Real Radio Hour on WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA. We'll be right back with more of Everything is Eel after this song by the Eel People called Eel People.
the Hudson River Estuary Program is putting on, and it's down in Poughkeepsie, and Chris Bowser will be a speaker, and there'll be a gathering of all the folks that have been volunteering on different streams in the river, and a little party to celebrate the end of the eel season. So if you're interested in attending, please give me a call. Thanks. Bye.
I was interested to meet more scientists and volunteers involved in the Eel Project at the end of the season celebration. So I arranged to carpool down with fellow Hanacroy Creek Eelers, Barbara, Mark, and Dee. I recorded our conversations in the car, and I'm glad I did because Dee told some really great eel stories. How long have you been working with eels?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I've been doing water education for at least 20 years. And eels were such a big part of it because they were so neat to have. Because the kids come on the boat like, they don't want to touch this thing, and all of a sudden they want to take one home, you know. Eels are fun. They really like the feel of being touched and petted, and, you know, they're just really weird. So I would have the kids spread their hands and put their hand in the water, and the eels would crawl through their fingers, and it was fun.
Oh, it's
fun.
A great teaching tool.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I discovered, too, that they like nail polish, and I can't figure out if it's the color or if it's the smell. And it's something about nail polish they love.
Now, Dee, I have to know, how did you discover that eels like nail polish?
Because the girls who had nail polish, and would put their hands in the water, the eels would come right over. And another one we had, I had a kid who had salami for lunch. And the eels went absolutely bonkers. They were all over that kid's hands and arms and just, you know.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Yeah.
So that had to have been smell.
Oh, it had to be all smell, sure. Yeah.
The best one I ever had, what I used to do is, I was down at the Port of Albany, so I would have the kids who worked on the boat put the eel trap in the water early in the morning, so when I got there, we'd have eels. And they would use whatever was left over from dinner the night before. And one morning I came in, they had pizza the night before. They put pepperoni in the trap. I had three beautiful eels about 2 feet long with gas. They were in a U-shape in the water with this bubble up in above
really?
The water.
Wow.
So I spent 2 hours burping eels. I'd rub their belly, the big bubble would come out. By the time we got back to the dock 2 hours later, they were flat in the water and I let them go. So working with the eels with the kids have been really kind of neat.
It's got some pretty good anecdotal stories on eels, though, I'm telling you.
They're fun.
We arrived in Poughkeepsie for the celebration where scientist Chris Bowser of the Hudson River Estuary Program was speaking to volunteers about the 2012 eel season.
The take-home lessons for 2012. We were a month earlier than usual. We had eels, we were looking at a catch per unit effort that was 8 to 10 times higher than we've ever seen before. I don't have a good answer as to why. Maryland, New Jersey, both report the same story. Early, huge numbers. It could be something to do in the ocean. It could be something to do with 2 years ago when the parents of this year's eels were leaving the East Coast. It might have been a big year for them. Maybe predators have been overfished. Maybe the Gulf Stream current has changed in such a way that more eels were delivered faster and fewer were eaten in the ocean. I don't know, but I can tell you this. A lot of us sciencey types over the summer are going to be crunching these numbers and trying to figure out why. And we are really going to be looking at next year to see, is this going to be a repeat performance? Are eels on their way back? We don't know, but 2012 was a good year. Remember, this is an animal whose range goes from Mexico to Greenland. This is actually a species that is pretty resilient to change in terms of temperature and timing. What they probably have more trouble with are things like dams and toxins and overfishing. So I think that the early arrival is the eels doing exactly what they do best. And I think it'll be interesting to see if these early arrivals continue or not. The only best way to find out is to come right back again next year and keep looking. Right now, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering the American eel for the United States Federally Threatened Species List. The data that you guys collect, that information doesn't just sit on a shelf in my office. That information goes to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They are going to be looking at the information collected by volunteers on the Fallkill, volunteers on the Passaic, volunteers on Black Creek. Your information actually goes into the management of the American eel. The future of that animal, it depends on what you guys are doing directly. When you guys take those eels and you slog them up above a dam and you let them go, that means that those 100 eels or those 2,000 eels have that much of a better chance to mature and swim back down to the Sargasso Sea. That's one more dam or barrier that they don't have to cross. That's one more chance of them not getting eaten. Thanks, it's just what I need. I appreciate that. So I really want to take a minute looking at the entire Hudson River watershed and all of the millions of people that live here. You guys here gathered under this roof have made a huge difference for the American eel. You continue to make a difference. I want you to give yourselves a huge round of applause.
I'm Dallas Sumsky, and I'm from Poughkeepsie, and I go to Poughkeepsie High School.
So is your school involved in the eel project?
Yeah, there were quite a few people that I knew that participated in it.
Why did you get in this project?
I got into this because it sounded really fun learning more about like the ecosystem and like how the water affects the other living animals and stuff like that. And it was fun to go in the water.
After the celebration, our conversations about eels continued on the car ride back from Poughkeepsie.
My first exposure to eels was the movie of the Tin Drum. And it was, you know, it was in a film. It wasn't real eels.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody pulls a horse's head out of the bay in Gdansk. And it's just, it's oozing with eels. And it's just such a revolting sight. It's a really vivid image. And in fact, I don't remember anything else about that film, but I remember the horse's head and all these eels coming out of it. The nostrils and the eye sockets and the ears and the mouth. It was just incredibly revolting.
I heard from somebody who's a rescue person, and they said a lot of times when you pull bodies out of the river, they have eels in them.
Oh, I bet they do, yeah. I suppose they're part of the decomposer set, aren't
they? Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, that's where they tend to find their way. You may want to cut this story out if you're recording, but I was watching this interesting documentary on television, and it was in South America, and they were documenting where this individual drove off the road, and it was, I'm not sure if it was an inlet from the sea or if it was a closed body of water, but anyway, when they pulled him out, they didn't find him for a while, so he was in the water, and when they found him, he had huge pieces of flesh ripped off. And they said, this is really impossible, because they said, well, there was a larger eel in there. And they said, there's no way. Eels have very small mouths, very small teeth.
Yeah.
And there's no way that they could rip that sort of flesh. Well, what they found out is that eels, well, which I guess is pretty common knowledge now, is eels can go just as fast backwards as they can forward.
Right.
And they also can rotate at a very high speed. So what they concluded and what they actually figured out was happening was the eels would latch on to the skin and then they would spin. And that's how they would.
So it ends up being like a drill bit.
Like a drill bit. And so they could rip off us. So small eels can, again, and that's probably as, you know, organisms are breaking down in the water, you know.
Right.
Whether they, you know, you'd walk in the water and they could take you down, you know.
They can't do that.
Right. you know, be something where the tissue had probably started to break down and they could take pieces of it.
It's not like there's going to be some episode of Eel's version of Jaws
when
you go swimming.
Send this to Spielberg. He'll whip something together, you know?
Yeah.
But even when I fed them even just worms, they'll do this spin thing, too.
It must be part of the process where they get how they rip things up.
Because they eat a lot of dead, you know, like when the stripers or the alewives and the shad and everything, they come up and die, and these guys get fat then. They feed on those things.
Yeah.
So that's probably the way they feed. They grab stuff and spin.
Yeah, and even when they're little, then they can take on something big that way.
Yeah. I had some once in the Mohawk. I had hip boots on, but I had light, and they're crawling all around my boots. I thought they were just looked curious, but maybe they were
looking for
food.
They're looking for a meal, Dee. Watch out.
But it was kind of cute because I had probably a dozen of them crawling in and out around my boots and checking things out.
Maybe as carrion feeders, the equivalent of the ocean-going crow.
Yeah, that's true, because they wouldn't find as much there.
That maybe they start to decompose themselves so that their young have something to feed on.
No, that's possible.
So that the young feed on the eel that has bred them.
Well, I think we've just come up with a list of about 50 questions.
Wow,
yeah,
this is some really good thesis is happening here.
Hi, Sam. It's Liz Lowe Judas. I'm calling because you are signed up for checking the EelNet today. And Sarah Mount, the person from DEC who directs the program, just called me and said there's supposed to be a whole ton of rain in the forecast and they want to pull the net and end the season today. So a couple volunteers, John and Alta and Ron, are going to pull the net at 5 this afternoon. So I just wanted to give you a heads up that if you go at the regularly arranged time, nobody's going to be there and the net's going to be out of the water. But if you're able and you want to go help with pulling the net, you are welcome to. And I'll also email you and hopefully you'll get this message.
I decided to go help with the net pulling and be part of this final stage of eel counting season. When I got there, John and Alta and Ron were in waders in the creek making one last eel count.
Come on,
John. Don't stab them.
Yahoo! Oh, he's getting to be big.
Great blue.
Oh. Great blue. Yeah, right.
Oh,
not bad.
Well, I'm doing it from a long perspective.
I know, but we've only gone one quarter of the way around.
Yeah.
Look at that guy. He's really big.
A dozen dips to get one the other day, and that was our count.
Oh, I see. It's tied.
Obviously, I don't have this.
We're looking for eels. Let's look. We're looking for eels.
I would say that none of these is really a glass eel anymore. Oh, maybe this guy is. One. Two. Boy, this one guy is seriously over.
There were a few eels in the net, but most of them had pigmentation, making them the slightly older elvers, the next stage after the glass eels.
So none of the eels are glassy at this point?
Well, they're all pigmented.
They're definitely pigmented.
There are a couple of the smaller ones that are still a little glassy, but they're all pigmented.
Is that because they're older?
Yeah.
That little bit of amount of time can make that difference?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the concept that what we're seeing is older guys.
Once the eels were removed from the net and put aside in a bucket to be counted and released, the process began to untie the net and take out the rebar poles and some rocks to be used in the following spring.
Tied this knot.
More than this thread.
I'm going to keep pointing at the display of the head, and I tie it off even more.
What we want to do is take like that end and bring it up there, and the rest of it has to, without ripping at the shred or doing any damaging on it, just pull it up.
But I can get that. This is the last thing.
You know, this would make a great permanent marker, like a gauge.
But is the net off it?
Yeah. Oh, well, not yet.
I don't think, actually, I'm not even sure it has a loop at the bottom here.
Good work.
Kind of real muddy for now.
Well, I've got this.
Get as much of me as I can, and I'll come back down.
We've got NASA, Houston, Atlantis, anybody. Okay.
Do you think you could grab part of this? Takes on a bit of an odor, doesn't it?
Grab it from underneath, yeah.
Oh! All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anybody got any more final day net pulling eel reminiscences or thoughts?
Well, I was here last year.
There was
that
big one that got away.
I came last year once, the same spot, and the net was out in the middle of the creek, and there was a snapping turtle. Well, at the time, I'd say he was this big, but he was probably only this big. But he was nestled up against, snugged up against
the net.
And water very clear, and you could see them, but as soon as we set foot in the water, scurried off.
It's been a fun project. It's been a fun project.
I'm really enjoying being a citizen scientist in this eel project, and I feel like I've learned so much in the last year. I'm finding myself now telling people all kinds of eel facts that I didn't formerly know, that I now know thanks to being in this project. And what's also interesting is very often when I start talking about eels to people, they then have their own eel story. So I'm really looking forward to this year's eel counting and can't wait to get out there.
I think that's one of the things that's so really cool about hands-on learning is actually getting out there and getting into the stream and experiencing the eels. Just is so engaging that you become fascinated with learning more, and you just become a sponge for all sorts of information. So I'm with you. I'm hooked on eels. And I... And I've noticed, I couldn't fail to notice, the gigantic full moon in the sky tonight, and it made me think that the water in the river is probably warm enough that right now as we speak, lots of glass eels are swimming up river, heading north, and they'll soon be heading into the Hanacroy Creek. So I can't wait to get my waders on either.
Great. I will see you out there.
Yes, I'll look forward to it.
Is there any contact information you want to give for any of our local listeners who might want to get involved?
Sure. We welcome more volunteers. The more the merrier. And they can, folks who are interested can send me an email at eml37@cornell.edu, or they can give me a call at 518-622-9820, extension 33.
Thanks, Liz. This was really fun.
Happy eeling, Sam.
We're looking for eels.
So you had your own eel liberation movement. What's that business about stomachs being dissolved? I didn't quite get that. The equivalent of the ocean going crow.
Yeah, and then she told me about this eel project, and I said, oh, I would love to do that. And then I got out here, and then we were talking, and we were like, this is a great story for the radio.
With the recorder or whatever.
They can come out of the water.
But they come out of the water.
Oh, yeah.
They can actually breathe through their skin.
I just think eels are fun.
This has been a special edition of the Nothing is Real Radio Hour called Everything is Eel. This program was co-produced by myself, Sam Sebrin, with environmental educator Liz Lojudis. The Nothing is Real Radio Hour is broadcast every fifth Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM for Free 103.9's Transmission Arts program.
Kept on walking on land, right?